Hello and welcome to Euractiv's Agri-Food Podcast. I'm Natasha Foote.
And I'm Gerardo Fortuna.
And here's your weekly update on all things agriculture and food in the EU from Euractiv's Agri-Food News team.
So on average, 86% of the population in European urban areas has access to fast broadband, while more than 40% of homes in rural areas still do not have it. And the need to speed up the broadband infrastructure of Europe's rural areas is crucial for the uptake of smart solutions in farming, such as precision farming, of course. Solution that will be able to provide tangible results for both local societies and environment. And today we're going to speak about this and other digital aspects of the European agriculture with Euractiv's digital editor, a good friend of ours, Samuel Stolton. Welcome to the Agri-Food Podcast, Sam.
Hi, guys. Very pleased to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're very happy to have you.
Such a high level guest, right, Tash?
I'm honoured to be stepping on the footsteps of one Sam Morgan after his appearance last week. So
All the Sams on the podcast.
Yeah, who's going to be next?
I need to find another Sam. Sams out there listening, get in touch.
We're actually offering you some leisure hours. I mean, taking you away from the coverage of the Digital Service Act. So, I mean,
yeah, actually, it's a welcome respite from that. It's complete chaos. As many of you who are listening and maybe following the ongoing debate with the DSA and the DMA will know that it's final few days now. But anyway, let's not talk about that. That's not what I'm here for.
No, back to agri.
Yeah. So our starting point today is the award ceremony of the Farming by Satellite Prize, the 2020 edition. This is a prize organized by the GSA, so the European agency in charge of managing operations and service provision of Galileo and EGNOS. There were five competing teams in this final proposing their innovative solutions that look to improve agriculture and reduce environmental impacts using the European satellite technologies. And the winner was, drumroll please, a project from Spain, Graniot. So basically it was a web application for agronomists and farmers to conduct weekly crop monitoring by using the European satellite technology. So the first thing that pops into my head is that these satellite-based systems are provided free of charge. So, I mean, we're talking about technology that was developed for civilian use, not like the Russian and the US ones, which were originally conceived for military purposes. So this opened, of course, a lot of possibilities that can be used by innovative businesses and public administrations as well. But at the same time, it needs investment, for instance, in equipment, and at the same time requires a good pre-existing infrastructure. So what's your take on this, Sam? I mean, could this act as a catalyst for more costs for farmers? I know it seems like a paradox.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily the farmers that should bear the cost. I mean, you know, they need a lot of financial support as it is. So I'm not quite sure whether they should be the ones to have an extra fiscal burden on themselves. But what I think is really important is for the EU to look at those countries in which these types of infrastructures are woefully underdeveloped. And if you take a look at this year's Digital Economy and Society Index, you've got certain countries such as Greece, Cyprus, Bulgaria, Croatia, that are well down the list in terms of their connectivity parameters. And it's these countries that really need the support much more than certain other countries, such as, by the way, Spain, that's got a fantastic connectivity track record. And even in the world of 5G, it's probably going to be EU's leading nation in that regard. So I think there's a lot of corners of Europe that are completely being left behind by the digital transition. Most of these are kind of concentrated to rural areas as well, like you say. We mustn't forget them, really, because without that investment in this type of infrastructure, they could lose out in the long term. And this affects the whole ecosystem. But it's not just about infrastructure and capacity building. It's also about skills and education. Like, I mean, not many farmers know how to operate a drone or know the insides of how to make the most of satellite navigation systems in order for precision farming techniques and things like that. So a lot of people say to me, in terms of capacity building and education and things like that, they say that the skills should come before the technology, because if the technology comes first, then people don't really know how to make the most of it.
And talking about kind of corners being left behind and woefully underdeveloped infrastructure. So as part of the Commission's efforts to achieve the goals of the Green Deal, they're looking to roll out broadband to these rural areas, as you were talking about. But, you know, we're talking about a huge undertaking. So they're saying that, that Europe needs to invest something like 200 billion euros for citizens in rural areas to have broadband access of at least 100 megabits per second. And I was just wondering, you know, where we're at, where the state of play is at the moment with that, and do you think this is something that's feasible?
Yeah, so I mean, that 200 billion figure is a bit vague, and I would love to see the calculations in that. But the Commission's going to look to encourage investment in broadband infrastructure through various instruments, including such things as the 2016 Broadband Cost Reduction Directive. The Commission launched a review of that recently. And effectively, the aim of this directive is to make sure that broadband is affordable for people and businesses, right? Because it can be quite expensive to roll out en masse, and particularly in certain parts of rural Europe where, depending on the type of connectivity, you know, roads have to be dug up and this infrastructure takes a lot of time to install and implement and things like that. That being said as well, in terms of broader connectivity goals, you have the goal outlined in the Electronic Communications Act, I believe it was called, that all member states would begin to deploy in some format 5G by the end of the year, or that they would have conducted their spectrum auctions by the end of the year for particular frequency bands. What we're seeing now in this arena is a mad rush from many countries across Central and Eastern Europe, particularly, to hold these auctions for 5G spectrum frequencies, because they know that actually they would be breaking the EU's electronic communications code if they didn't do that. They would be breaching EU law. So there's a mad rush for 5G at the moment. But of course, this comes hand in hand with a lot of the risks that people have raised with regards to the security of the network infrastructure, the geopolitical concerns, and of course, the protection of data. Now, we're not talking about personal data when it comes to farming. We're talking about industrial data. And the EU, of course, has other plans in that area that maybe we can talk about a bit later on.
I briefly follow up on the navigational aspects, which actually are the backbone of digitalization in every sector. And of course, agriculture is no exception. So we're talking about Copernicus that provides detailed pictures of the fields, Galileo that indicates the position, and EGNOS, which is an additional tool that corrects the signal, and because it could be distorted due to, for instance, atmospheric disturbances. And all the three together lower the number of required on-the-spot checks because they make them easier. And this could also lead to, I mean, first, a better spending of taxpayers' money because it costs less money because you don't have to do this on-the-spot check. Because, of course, we're talking about instruments that are able to clarify what is happening in a field and sometimes without even visiting a farm, which of course, saves financial resources. But and the first priority of the next Common Agricultural Policy is less bureaucracy. But it is also true that farmers, they feel more like controlled. And Sam, this aspect of control is something that goes hand in hand with digitalization, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I mean, it's a very, very broad subject, and I haven't personally spoken to any farmers about living.
Should.
I should do, yeah. I don't actually know any, which is rather embarrassing.
Well, you're in the right place, don't worry.
Yes, yeah, with your active farming crowd. The question I believe you're asking, Gerardo, is are farmers aware really of the zeitgeist of surveillance capitalism? I have no idea. I mean, of course, this is a topic that's incredibly pertinent in other technology communities, such as those who work in artificial intelligence advocacy, or those who work in as part of our privacy communities or in data protection. You know, they are incredibly aware of the age of surveillance capitalism and the types of worrying uses of these data streams by the public sector or governmental bodies or organizations. I must admit, I'm not an expert in the type of data that can be extracted from farming processes, but I find it hard to believe that farmers can get that, defensive about their data being siphoned off. Maybe they do. It depends on.
It depends, because even subsidies are linked to a certain aspect. Right. That, I mean, with, you know, you can escape the eye of a machine, let's say.
Well, I think the difference is as well, because I know you said earlier something about, you know, it's not personal data, it's industrial data. But I think what is really particular about the farming community is that, you know, there's not really that distinction. You know, for these people, this is their livelihoods, is their way of life. I think it's kind of actually incredibly personal for many farmers. And, you know, I think we talk a lot about data protection concerns and personal data to do with things like health. But I don't think that we have in my opinion, actually, I should ask you whether we have enough kind of focus on this in agriculture and, you know, how we can kind of protect this data. Because I do think it is something that's kind of can be incredibly sensitive.
Well, yeah. And I mean, this is going to be one of the big challenges of the EU's data strategy, right, which is to distinguish between what is industrial data, which the EU wants to liberalise and make the most out of, and what is personal data, which effectively the Commission has ring-fenced and protected under the GDPR and various other instruments like the e-privacy directive, which is, again, supposed to become a regulation, but member states haven't been able to agree on a position with Parliament yet. I think agriculture does get lost out in this debate, in the wider kind of media sphere of things. And there's a lot of talk around health data, of course, at the moment, because we're living in the middle of a pandemic, and people are aware of both the innovative applications of health data, but also the fact that these are incredibly sensitive data streams that many people wouldn't want disclosed in the public domain. With the specific example of farming data, yeah, Natasha, I think you're absolutely right. I think the difficulty here of distinguishing between what is personal and what is non-personal is going to be so challenging, particularly in this sector, because you imagine a farmer's everyday working life. I mean, he lives at his workplace. So the data streams that can be extracted from that activity in terms of like working hours or the temperature of the soil or how often, I don't know, plants or certain things are watered or feeding times. I can imagine this would reflect quite strongly actually on how that farmer himself or his team works on a day-to-day basis. I'm not an expert on farming or agriculture, so I don't know the types of data streams that could be extracted from that activity, but I would imagine, yeah, there would be a lot of difficulty in distinguishing between that personal and non-personal kind of bifurcation.
And I think you're right. I mean, it is just kind of a bit of an unknown kind of, you know, what, how this data can be shared and the ramifications of it, which is, you know, what you were talking about.
When you guys speak to farmers, how do they feel about the rapid digitalization of their sector?
Obviously, each farmer you speak to is it's a different story. It's not kind of a homogenous kind of thing. I think definitely you know, we're seeing, we can see a lot of the real benefits from what can come from it. And, you know, it's very exciting to be kind of innovating and things. But there's definitely, I think, a lot of farmers I've spoken to, this kind of reluctance or like a reticence of, well, what are you going to do with my data? And, you know, and for them, I think it's not always clear what's going to happen. And I think they're very kind of protective, as you said, over their livelihoods.
What data are they most concerned about?
Some of the data that you were referring to about, you know, the quality of your land, the quality of your soil, things like that can then have a real massive ramification on like their land value if they then want to sell something. Or, you know, if you know when a farmer's going to plant something, then seed companies will know when to put the prices up of a certain seed because they know the pattern, things like that. You know, there's, I think quite, and that's obviously we're just talking maybe economic. I'm sure there's also other ramifications.
But also, as well, what Gerardo said about subsidies, if you have some sort of data that could expose maybe the fact that you don't need as much money as your government you did, then of course I can imagine certain farmers wouldn't be too happy about that.
Well, I remember when I was working in Greece, we had the farmers there were very reluctant because there was in the past there were kind of pictures taken of the farms, and if you had a certain percentage of tree cover, you were then suddenly not in the farming subsidies, you weren't eligible for certain subsidies. And they were very, very scared of that. And they didn't want, because they always had olive groves and they had sheep underneath it. And there was a fear that photos taken from above would not reflect what they were, you know, what was really going on. Yes, they had trees, but it wasn't, whatever, it had to be a certain percentage. Things like that. I think there was a reluctance to kind of get involved. At the same time, we used drones when we were in Greece, and it was like so useful to map out the land and lay out our contours and stuff. So we can kind of see the benefits. And
in terms of control, I mean, we're talking about a constant collection of data. So, I mean, farmers are kind of used to, again, on the spot check that could last one day, but even 1 week, and then once the expert or the tax authority had collected all the things he needs for his assessment or his or her assessment, and then it's over, no? While, for instance, the involvement of this satellite systems, again, you are 24-hour kind of control, no? The amount of data that could be shared with tax authority or in general involve a wide range of aspects of the farming practices.
Yeah, definitely. And I think if applied erroneously, it can be used as a apparatus of control, for sure. And even more concerning, in the context of the EU's liberalisation of industrial data, if it makes that data available to competitors as well, or it forces certain farmers to share particular data streams with competitors, you know, this could be used to completely destabilize the market. Mm. So there are concerns there that I don't think are being raised.
And another concern that is quite mentioned by farmers, it's on something that you mentioned, Sam. It's basically the skills, not the education, because they think that investment should be directed not only towards research and development, but also towards the practical implementation of new technologies on the ground. So, for instance, I spoke with a farmer once, and he said that there's a new heat detection technology that could offer the livestock farmers the option to manage their herds more efficiently. But in the end of the day, it is simply very expensive to get things works, and farmers are not keen to invest such an amount due to a lack of knowledge. I mean, it costs a lot. I don't understand that much how to put in place this technology. So this is another concern. It's not involving the data. It's a quite common concern from farmers when it comes to digitalization.
Yeah, of course. So the things you've got to look at in this context are the skills agenda, or I should say rather the revised skills agenda that the Commission published, September, I think it was. And they also published the Digital Education Action Plan. The Commission recognises this need to upskill and reskill many of Europe's workers who have kind of been left behind by the digital transition, or are being left behind by the digital transition. And of course, this isn't only a generational thing. This cuts across all sorts of different demographics who are being left behind by the digital revolution. And they're just not going to be so mobile in the jobs market of the future, particularly if you imagine young farmers today going to agricultural school. What types of subjects are most pertinent for their future career? You would imagine there to be quite a substantial attention paid to digitalization in the farming world. But of course, many, many institutions and educational establishments across the European Union haven't quite modernized to an extent by which they are teaching their students about the importance of technology and digitalization in this sector. And it's not only that, but it's also reaching out to, you know, the age-old farmers who have been doing the same business for decades, and letting them know, actually, you can massively improve efficiency with the help of some of these digital tools. And I imagine, actually, that many of these farmers would be quite reluctant to change their ways. It's regarded, from my very ignorant perspective of the farming industry, but you imagine it as a very traditional type of business. I believe the encouragement has to be there, and the support has to be there. Most importantly, the money has to be there to reskill and retrain these farmers.
There's this issue of the technological neutrality, so basically, you know, preferring a certain technology over another. And at the moment, the agriculture sector is quite neutral, I would say. You don't have like the debate that you had 5 or 10 years ago in the energy sector, when there was a struggle between, technologies when it comes to digitalization. I don't know if you're a fan of neutrality, but it is something that every sector are bound to face. So basically, deciding which kind of technology to support or to promote.
Mm. Well, I think technology neutrality, the concept itself, is quite nebulous and vague, particularly in terms of its application. I think in theory, it's always a good idea to, you know, adopt a position where no technology is necessarily preferential to another one. Particularly, I think, for sectoral uses, it should necessarily be about efficiency, and it should be about respect for the EU's fundamental values in terms of the criteria by which certain technological applications are preferred to others. And, you know, this is something that I think the Commission would support itself. Of course, there are geopolitical implications to this as well. There are certain technologies emanating from distant corners of the earth that simply would never be able to be applied across a mass sector in the European Union because of the country they come from. And we're seeing more and more of this in the connectivity space with regards to the provision of 5G infrastructure and, you know, certain Chinese firms in particular. I think technology neutrality has its merits, but the concept, the theory, is caught up in a wider ecosystem of very, very complicated and nuanced arguments that don't make it so easy. I think diversity in the market is always massively important. But again, you have to, you know, choice is important for farmers as well. And each farmer has their own way of doing things, and they should be given the freedom to decide upon which technologies perform the tasks most efficiently, I believe. And of course, the kind of wide scope and multifaceted patchwork of farming on the European Union should mean that there will be a diverse scope of technologies offered up to the market. And, you know, that should be something embraced by farmers from all cloths.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today. It's been great to pick your brains on this and hear your thoughts on this. I definitely need to brush up a bit more on my digital knowledge. So that's been, it's been really interesting.
Thank Pleasure. You. Thank you for having me on.
So this week there was an interesting report that came out from the consumer advocacy group Safe Food Advocacy Europe, or known as then also known as SAFE, and this report was looking at the term natural on food products. So you've probably seen on food products things like 100% natural, all natural ingredients. Well, this report is basically saying that these kind of terms are pretty much baseless. They're actually not really got clear guidelines or definitions at the EU level for what it means, for what you need to have in the products to call it natural. And so they're saying that this kind of label can be misleading for consumers. And so they looked at the composition of hundreds of products that are currently available on the market. And this includes things like soft drinks, sauces, sweets, and they found that many that use a natural claim actually include synthetic substances such as flavorings and synthetic e-numbers. So this is pretty interesting. And, you know, they're calling for the EU to kind of step up and do something and provide a legal definition of what can be considered natural. So I spoke to an EU source who told me that at the moment, you know, while the Commission is open to considering proposals to improve legislation, there isn't actually currently a concrete plan to define the term natural for general use on food labelling. But this is also pretty interesting because in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic, we've seen a renewed interest from people in kind of healthier foods and maybe eating more naturally is part of that. So we've seen more of an interest from consumers in buying things that you know are perceived as natural or maybe better for you or healthier. So it is a pretty interesting moment for the report to come out. So yeah, how about you, Gerardo? Did that attract you as a consumer?
It's true. It's true what you said. There's the same pattern even when it comes to health. So there's a rethinking of the natural component. Because, I mean, for instance, even in terms of promoting innovation in healthcare, no, the EU has always been a bit more, you know, leaning toward synthetic or you know, artificial drugs, let's say. So there's this shift toward the rediscovering the natural components. Of course, we're not talking about replacing, but I mean, there's a place even for this again, natural products, of course. So it's quite interesting. It's quite interesting, and I think that we're gonna see more on this aspect, even because I mean the regulatory aspects are not that clear. I mean, you know that in the EU there's this novel food category, which is like a huge category. Where are listed all the food stuff that have been conceived after 1999, I think. You know, I think that we could also expect to move on this this novel food approach and some of this food that actually involve also natural aspects need a better definition.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, regardless of what your personal opinion is on things, it's more about, you know, when you buy something, you want to know what you're buying, you know, kind of this.
Also because it's, you know, there's a new focus on labeling and of course, I mean, we're talking about the front of pack of foodstuff. So, yeah, it's also linked to the... And again, the one of the main objectives of the Farm to Fork strategy is this push, you know, this nudge for consumers to make the healthier choice.
And to inform consumers so that they can make, you know, whatever decision they want to make, whether it's the healthy one or not, you know, it's not for me to judge, but that they understand enough to make that decision. So it's interesting to kind of put natural as well in part of the equation. We talk mostly about things like origin labeling and nutrition labeling, but it's an additional interesting component of the labeling debate, I'd say.
And you know what's interesting?
What's that?
I can give you this news. It seems that the European Parliament and the Commission made up after the...
That is interesting.
I mean, we were worried.
There were some sleepless nights there worrying.
Yeah, they're trying to restore the mutual trust, you know, after the recent, you know, quarrels about
spat.
The spat about the reform of the Common Agricultural Policy. You remember it was Timmermans. Actually, we speak about this like every week. So Timmermans hinted that at the possibility of retracting the Commission proposal, while actually the negotiators are negotiating. So the Parliament was a bit irritated. I mean, particularly the negotiator, because, for instance, the Greens group is in favor of Timmermans' stance. There was this European Parliament's Agriculture Committee hearing at the beginning of the week, I think on Monday, and there was and actually the commissioner spoke on Tuesday, because it was a 2-day hearing session, and basically, you know, it's during the hearing some MEPs demanded further clarification on the Commission's stance. It's still not clear. It's still not clear because, I mean, the Commission keeps open the door for withdrawal. Not at this stage, but you never know. For instance, there was the Italian MEP, Herbert Dorfman, who's also the agriculture coordinator of the largest party, the European People's Party, Christian Democrats, that basically said that the Commission should tone it down and ensure that there is a genuine dialogue on the strategic plans, which is one of the core aspects of the Common Agricultural Policy reform. And so the impression of some MEPs is that the Commission is more acting as a defender of sustainability rather than an honest broker. And actually, Wojciechowski told MEPs that the EU executive is determined to play its role of an honest broker during the negotiation, but at the same time, being a driver for greater sustainability. So, in the end, they made up, but I mean, the issue is still unsolved.
And this week, something else interesting that happened was that the EU Ombudsman released a report about the procedure for the approval of active substances and pesticides, where they criticised the procedure and outlined several recommendations for measures to improve the approval process and also increase its transparency. So the conclusion basically evaluates the method by which the European Commission approves these active substances. And it concluded that where the European Food Safety Authority, so EFSA, identifies critical areas of concern or does not identify a safe use, the Commission should seek clarifications from EFSA before approving the active substance in question in accordance with the precautionary principle. So that's not actually necessarily what happens at the moment. So basically, for an active substance to be approved on the EU market, the producer must first submit an application to EFSA. EFSA carries out a scientific risk assessment, and this provides the basis of the EU Commission's approval or its conditions for the approval. But basically, the Pesticide Action Network Europe, known as Pan Europe, is an NGO that works campaigns against pesticides. They filed a complaint a few years ago with the Ombudsman Office, basically denouncing what they consider to be unlawful approvals of active substances. And this is because of the Commission's practice of approving certain substances when either there was no safe limit that was identified yet, or there's also this kind of method known as confirmatory data, and that is when maybe there'll be an approval of a substance, but we'll be awaiting additional data to come later. The EU Ombudsman, basically, they concluded that this kind of practice raises concerns They were fairly critical, actually, in the report, which was quite interesting. And so, you can check it out. It's online. You can check out the article on Euactiv for more details.
I'd say it was a very good investigative reporting, also because the new ombudsman, Emily O'Reilly, she's a former journalist, actually.
Is she?
Yeah.
Ah, that explains her thorough.
Yeah, indeed.
Because it was very thorough, this report. So it's quite interesting. Because the conclusion is not actually legally binding, but it is interesting. And also it obviously comes in the context of with the farm to fork strategy, looking to take action over pesticide use and risk.
And speaking of the farm to fork strategy, one of the measures that are listed in the EU flagship food policy is the one that tried to address the misuse of date marking that actually lead to a significant amount of food waste. We're talking about the use by or best before date that we see on the front of pack of our food products. So although they seem similar, the use by date on food is about safety, food safety, of course. So meaning that food should not be eaten after this day, regardless of appearance. While the best before refers to quality, meaning that food is still safe to eat after this date, but may not be at its best, let's say. So the European Food Safety Agency, EFSA, has presented a new tool to help business operators deciding when to apply the use by or best before date to their products, which is a tool intended to cut food waste, of course, because we see that, for instance, that there was the European Commission estimates that up to 10% of the 88 million tons of food waste generated every year in the EU is linked to date marking on products. But at the same time, this is a very long-standing issue. There was an Agri-Fish Council, so a gathering of ministers, in 2014, where there was the first attempt made by a coalition of member states to provide some exception indication in the indication of the expiry date for products. So it would have led to the best before reference disappear, but it was challenged by another group of countries led by Italy. I remember that the then agriculture minister, Martina, argued that the solution for reducing food waste was not by discussing the label issue alone, and that quality of food products was as important as their safety for Italy and these countries. So this new tool could actually reopen, this long-standing issue, and also the Netherlands, before the preparation of the launch of the Farm to Fork strategy, the Dutch government again proposed to extend the list of products that do not need date marking, as they do not present any health risk in order to tackle food waste. So watch this space, and this could be a very interesting topic to follow up on in the coming months.
10% of 88 million tons, that's considerable.
Indeed.
Down to labels is not an insignificant amount, so...
And again, it's adding more fuel to the already, inflammatory discussion over food labeling.
Yeah. Yeah, more discussions on labeling.
This week, the Agri-Food Podcast is produced by Euractiv's Agri-Food team, Gerardo Fortuna and Natasha Foot. Be sure to subscribe to our newsletter so you don't miss the latest agricultural news from the EU.
And this podcast is also available on all major streaming platforms, so that includes Apple, Amazon, Spotify, and Stitcher. I'm Natasha Foote. Thank you for listening, and see you next week.